global warming. What I hope to do is to show you how the issue arises, to discuss whether it is something that we ought to be concerned about, whether we should be concerned about in terms of its real impacts, or whether we more should be concerned about its imaginary impacts, its social impacts. Because the topic is bedeviled by a discussion which focuses on fact-free assertion, has become almost religious, so that if you apply normal scientific scepticism to some of the assertions of the Greens, you were treated as a denier, a disbeliever. And if you're a sinner and emit too much carbon dioxide, you can get yourself a dispensation in the form of a carbon permit to allow you to do that and go back into grace. And I really, this evening, want to challenge that view of the world quite significantly. But in order to get us to a sensible point of departure, the first thing we should discuss is why is it that we need what's in common parlance called so much energy, and which really should be called power. What's happened in the modern world is that we have, each of us, especially in the developed nations, but even in the developing nations, acquired quite a substantial coterie of servants who assist us to do things, who transport us, who clean our dishes for us, who prepare our food for us by expending energy. More properly, power, but I'll stick with energy since it's what people normally use. And you can see the genesis of this. Back in 1890, we began to burn coal. In the 20s, we began to burn oil. And now, more recently, we burn gas, we use hydropower, we use nuclear, and we use a little bit of renewables. And the reason for that growth is that as we've become technologically cleverer, we've developed machines which require power to make them work, and they make our lives better in many ways. No one forces us to buy and use these machines, nor do they force us to buy the fuel that goes into them. This is a rather more expanded view, starting in 87, showing what the use of different coal, different energy sources are. And the key thing is, from this picture, is our energy use is dominated by the combustion of fossil fuels. And the emissions from fossil fuels are primarily carbon dioxide and water. There are also some toxic and noxious emissions, toxic and irritant emissions, like nitrogen oxides and sulfur dioxide, but technologically they are solved problems. There are good technologies for removing those emissions from the emitted combustion gas streams. The emission that we have no foreseeable technology for dealing with is carbon dioxide. There have been attempts to develop carbon sequestration technologies to collect it and store it. They have all failed, and there is no good technical solution for that anywhere on the horizon. The best carbon storage device on the planet is the ocean. So, do we have a difficulty in converting this energy into useful forms of goods? This is normally measured by gross domestic product. It's measured in money. So you can look at the consumption in kilowatt hours of millions of barrels of oil or any handy unit and see how much good you get out of that. That's economic good. And from that, you can get a sense of what the energy efficiency of a particular nation is. And that's what's plotted here. And you can see that in the UK, we do really quite well. We have an economy which is efficient in converting energy into product. This is a somewhat different way to see it, and to see where the countries are located. What we have along here is kilowatts per head, and what we have up here is gross domestic product per head. So as you go up this axis, you get richer. You can see America is well up and Japan. This data is from 2006 from the International Energy Agency report. And along here, it takes you more energy. So again, you can see the UK is doing pretty well. Though if we were as energy efficient as the Japanese, we would all be about 50% richer. Now, of course, there is an element of proper currency purchasing power in there, but I won't go into that. But equally, you can see that the American economy is not as energy efficient as the UK one. Because if the Americans were as energy efficient as us, there would be a straight line projection which would suggest that they also would be rather wealthier than they are now. What is absolutely true is that there is a strong correlation between national prosperity and energy burn. Now, the talk short, and I didn't bring the picture with me, but what you can see is if you look into that, that the energy efficiency of nations is converging, and it's converging quite quickly in the developed world.
Excuse me, what does that kilowatt mean? Is that kilowatt averaged over a year? The kilowatt hours averaged over a year?
Yes, right? Yes, it's the average kilowatt consumption. It's the mean consumption per capita.
Yeah, well, it should say that.
Yeah, okay.
So it's power, not energy.
It's power. It's average power. But average power times time gives you the energy. So we're burning fossil fuels at the moment, and it is undoubtedly the case that one fine day they will run out. And so a question is, will they run out soon? And perhaps a more important question is, when they run out, what can we do? What the fossil fuels have done is stored up energy over many millions of years, and we are burning them at a much greater rate than they were accumulated. So when they run out, are we going to face social collapse? Well, the answer is no. We have a technology challenge, but there is lots and lots of energy around. Up here, this tiny little cube is the annual world consumption of energy. And this big white cube is the energy which arrives annually from the sun. So there is, we are well away from any reasonable bound on the amount of energy that we could obtain on a continuous basis from the sun. So long term, there is not a problem, providing we can discover how to convert solar energy into energy which is useful to us for the purposes for which we wish to apply it. You can also learn from this diagram, and I'll show you a couple of other graphs which make the point more readily, that there is no early prospect of oil or gas running out, and there is a very large amount of coal around. Also, there's enough uranium. So all of these sources of fuel essentially pose technology challenges. How do we use them in an acceptable way? You can see that the wind resource, the hydro resource, is quite small. So if we hear a lot about the idea that the oil is running out, we need to worry about that. That is not true. If the oil was running out, you would expect to see this graph, which is the ratio of reserves to use. So it tells you how many years you have left in reserves. If it was running out, if we found it all, it would drop at a year. So we'll have lots of notice of the oil running out because the curve will turn. This data stops in 2008. The latest estimate says that we have about 50 years of oil left. This is running between 40 and 50. The reason for that is that there's been an economic downturn and our rate of usage is smaller and extra resources have been discovered. what's called tight oil, which is shale oil, and tight gas. But gas is not on this slide. But if we turn to... Oh, the other point to make is, where is it? It's mostly in the Middle East. That is a political problem, but it is not a technical problem. So there is no good reason to worry about oil running out. Same's true of gas. Here it tops out around 60, but again, it's the same problem. It's in the Middle East. It gets better when you look at coal. There are hundreds of years' worth of coal left. So we don't have a crisis in the supply of fossil fuels. What we do have is a political issue, because the primary supply of the fuels we like most, that is oil and gas, is in the Middle East, and the Middle East is notably politically unstable. And I have the graph but won't show it. You can see the price of oil varies very strongly with political events in the Middle East. In contrast, if you look at coal, despite the recent discussions about spying, the USA is actually a friend. If you turn them at the front door with dollars, they'll sell you the coal. And they're politically stable enough that you would expect that it would be delivered. And there are very, very large volumes of coal available. So there's a technical problem about whether we wish to burn it. Now, interestingly, and it's been a lot in the press here, there is a new fuel source that's come on stream strongly in America, but where we have here in the UK probably very large reserves, enough to make us sort of reverse the situation that we're in the moment, where we have ceased to be self-sufficient in oil and gas, and again, net importers. And this is predicted to grow very rapidly, especially in this decade. Now, this is speculative, of course, but the technology for doing this is established well in America. And there are issues with it. The way it works is you drill a hole down to the shale that bears the gas, and then you pump water into the shale-bearing rock to break it up and release the trapped oil or gas. Now, when the water gets to the shale level, there is essentially no evidence that it penetrates beyond the shale layer. But there is evidence that when people don't put the wells down very well, they can leak, and that can allow gas to get into the water table. And you might think that that is a terrible problem, but in fact it isn't. It is relatively simple and established technology to do liquid gas separation. And if I had an artesian well in America and I discovered I had methane in my water, I would actually be quite pleased, because what I would do is install a low-cost liquid gas separation plant and use the methane to heat my house or run my car. So it's easy to make alarmist stories, but in fact, shale recovery is going to turn America into a net exporter of gas. And that will probably bring down international gas prices and alleviate the political pressures associated with the Middle East. However, there is this key issue that comes from the combustion of fossil fuel. It emits water, and water might or might not be a problem, I'll come to that later. It certainly emits carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide, as most people learn in school, is a greenhouse gas. And what that means is it traps heat. It traps heat and things get warmer. And so there is a debate which asserts, one side asserts, that humans, through generating these carbon dioxide emissions, are likely to raise the planetary temperature to such a degree that catastrophe will ensue. Now, as I'll try to persuade you in a couple of minutes by showing you some data, I don't believe that there is any sound evidence for that at all. But let's look at the argument. It has five stages. Human use of fossil fuels generates carbon dioxide. That is absolutely true. carbon dioxide is a solar radiation trapper, that's true too. And as a result, the Earth is warmer. Absolutely true. It's measurable, and it's also predictable at the measured level. That we've increased atmospheric CO2 concentration by about 40% since 1850. But if you remember the first graph, because the fuel burn has got much bigger more recently, most of that has happened since 1950. Absolutely true, and that is inescapable because you can measure the isotopic composition of the CO2 in the atmosphere and determine that it has come from fossil fuel burn. But it's this final statement which I believe to be false. And the statement then is we should therefore expect significant global warming from this emission. Well, not true in my view. If you calculate the emission, the increase in temperature that will arise from carbon dioxide emissions, it's about half a degree centigrade, degree Fahrenheit. So why is it that the climate modellers say we should expect much bigger temperature increases?
Over what period is that half degree?
That's at equilibrium, at infinity, because the absorption is a logarithmic process. So if you double the concentration, you don't double the absorption.
So that's the half a degree C. That's for the 40%.
It would be half a degree if you trapped all of the heat that comes in the carbon dioxide band.
The one that we have now.
Sorry?
The one that we have now. The amount of CO2 that's in the atmosphere.
No. If you can't put out enough carbon dioxide to trap all of the heat, it's an exponential process, so it tails off smoothly towards 100%. The amount untrapped goes down exponentially as you increase concentration.
So you're saying if you put out all the world's carbon into the atmosphere, it would still only go up by half a degree?
Yes.
Since when? What period of time?
Whenever.
Since 1850.
You can do a black body calculation. Let me press on and see if it comes clear. If not, we'll come back to it. Okay? So what this says is if you trap all of the radiation that comes in the carbon dioxide bands and subject that to the greenhouse effect, so you put out as much as you like, then the net heating would be of this order. Now, we already have enough carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to trap about 90% of the insulation in the bands where it absorbs. And so adding to the concentration makes very little difference to the addition. And the way the climate modellers obtain their rather more alarming results is they make the following assertions. They say, well, it's got warmer, about half a degree to 1 degree. Because of that, the oceans will evaporate more. So more water vapour will go into the atmosphere, and water vapour is a much more profound greenhouse gas than water.
Water is a
much more intense greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And so there's an amplification effect. And the models can't calculate that because the calculations you would need to do a first principles calculation are beyond existing computer capacity and likely to remain so for a very long time. One of the things I used to be involved in is the modelling of diesel engine combustion. And a diesel engine combustion chamber, or gas turbine combustion chamber, is a much less complex object than the Earth and its atmosphere. And it is not possible to do first principles calculations of multi-phase flow with heat transfer in those circumstances. And so what the meteorologists necessarily do is put in a multiplier, which in engineering we would call a fudge factor, and use that. And you can make plausibility arguments for choosing the fudge factor But the best way to do it is by adjusting it in the light of data. So let's have a quick gallop past this. Shows yes, the carbon dioxide emissions have gone up. There's an absorber out there in the form of the ocean, and so the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere hasn't gone up in proportion, because some of the carbon dioxide is absorbed and used to deposit limestone and all sorts of other things at the bottom of the ocean. This is the rather complicated thing that goes on. This is incoming visible, if you like, some of which is reflected by clouds, that's an important point for a moment or two, some of which reflected by the earth, some of it in being reflected is captured by greenhouse gases and then re-radiated back to the earth. That's how the greenhouse effect works. And the carbon dioxide absorption occurs in wavelength bands. Carbon dioxide is transparent to most of the radiation that arrives at it, otherwise you wouldn't see the sun. And so only about 8% of the incoming heat is able to be trapped. And about, at the present carbon dioxide levels, about 80% of the effective trapping is already occurring. So there's a reason for scepticism there about, if you like, the ANZACs. Is it credible that you would expect catastrophic effects from what is actually a trace gas, even if you triple the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it would remain a trace gas. Water is much more prevalent and is a much more efficient emitter. But the difficulty in using the argument for amplification by water vapour is that, A, it's rather difficult to measure the mean global concentration of water vapour because it's widely varying, unlike CO2, which mixes out as a gas. Secondly, the dynamics of water in the atmosphere are not terribly well understood. When it gets up there, it can either stay as a vapour or it can condense, form clouds, which are reflective and reduce heating. If they're high, if they're low, and at night, they trap heat and increase temperature. And also, if you get clouds, as we know in England, to our cost, it rains a lot. So what you would expect is if the temperature has gone up half a degree or so, that you might enhance the water circulation. And again, you could either say, gosh, that's terrible, or you could say, well, one of the crises facing humanity as its population grows is a shortage of fresh water. And here we have the atmosphere nicely purifying the water for us and re-delivering it in rain. So what you would expect is a slight increase in the stirring force. And I think that in some sense is what we're seeing. The other question you might worry about is the intrinsic enhancement of water vapour into the atmosphere from the combustion process itself at a damaging level? Well, what this plots here is the tiny effect of man-made emissions of water compared with natural water vapour in the atmosphere. It's small. It's a sort of megalomania where people think that man has a huge impact. The same is true with methane and other gases.
Can you just go back a moment?
Yep.
I may be silly, but how come we've got five different plot things there and only three?
Yes, this is methane. There's another one here. They were up and down. It hasn't transcribed the slide terribly well.
Actually, maybe I can ask you before you move on to the CO2, from the CO2. Is it one of the arguments that the wavelength is altered? when it's reflected off the Earth. So
those are the bands that are short. The absorption bands. The absorption bands are always the same. You can't change the absorption bands. That's a feature of the molecule.
Yes.
Okay. So here you have the absorption bands. The point is that the light which arrives from the sun is at a high frequency. It has a high availability because of the solar temperature.
Yes.
It gets to Earth, it's re-radiated back at a much lower frequency in the infrared, which actually gets to the absorption bands. So they absorb and then re-emit two directions, one back to the Earth and one off to space.
Right.
So the bands stay the same.
And you're saying that would alter the effect of the solar radiation by 8%? 8% of the solar radiation, is that correct?
No. About 8% is capable of being absorbed. About 8% of the arriving solar radiation is in the bands where it can interact with CO2. Okay, so that's the maximum impact that you can have on solar radiation. The radiation gets in.
That sounds like quite a lot, from the amount of, given that the solar radiation is so huge.
Well, you have to then, let's see, here we are, 324 back radiation. So it is significant. So that's the maximum effect of CO2. But we have almost all of that effect present now. Because the CO2 band, the CO2 concentration that we have at the moment, absorbs about 80% of the incoming radiation. If we doubled it, it would absorb 88%. Because it's essentially a logarithmic dependency. Has that dealt with the question or not?
Yes, I think there's another one there.
Uh-huh.
So is what you're saying that the relationship between the amount of CO2 and the amount of solar radiation that's converted into heat. What you're saying is that's not a linear relationship.
That's right.
Do you have a graph of that?
It's an exponential decay. It's e to the minus.
I
don't have it, but I mean that's one of the ground zero things. If you just look at absorptions, it's e to the minus concentration times length.
Why is it an exponential decay?
Because the amount remaining to be absorbed is depleted, so it's a it's a multiplicative thing. It's because you're doing a differential equals a constant, okay, with an inverse, and so you get a logarithmic relationship.
It doesn't seem to make sense, though. I mean, if you use something simple like Beer-Lambert law, that's a pretty good model for absorption with the amount of with the concentration of some attenuating species.
Yeah.
Increase the amount of something that absorbs radiation.
The attenuation goes up linearly. The absorption is e to the essentially attenuation coefficient times the concentration. So that's where the exponential comes.
Okay.
Sorry, just what are these numbers again, please?
Oh, this is.
Yes, I think it's important clarification.
Essentially, they're simply indicators of the radiation level so that you can do comparisons.
But are they based on
power? Can you let Philip carry on? Let's go back to this if we need to at the end.
I mean, in a sense, this is not the contentious bit of it. This is all terribly well served. So, if we have concern about a relationship between global temperature and carbon dioxide concentration, we can look to get some data. And one sort of data that's available is ice cores and very, very historic data. And what this graph shows is a plot of, now let me get them the right way around, the blue is average global temperature, and the black is atmospheric CO2. Now, I look at that and I don't see a correlation. So there is not clearly a simple causal relationship between atmospheric CO2 and average global temperature. It certainly affects it, but it affects many other things also. And then Oh. This is another, I think, really quite interesting diagram coming from the Natural History Museum. What the Natural History Museum is interested in is in extinctions in the UK. And so it plots oxygen level, which is a sort of indicator for temperature, and extinctions over quite a long time scale. And the interesting thing is that the extinctions occur when it gets too cold, never when it gets too hot. And there is, I think, significant evidence that a little extra CO2 is quite good for you. If it gets warmer, crops grow better, mankind prospers. And there is some evidence, which I haven't brought in the historical record, that suggests that to be true. But this is much more modern data. This is the period between 1978 and 2012. And a good way to measure global temperature is to sit very far away and get an average by looking at as much of the planet as you can at a go with a satellite. And this is what it shows. It shows that the temperature wobbles around a lot, but the rises are of the order of the ones that I've described. But the time of the great global warming hysteria, 97-98, shows a strong spike. Not well understood, but there is a strong spike, but it was not the indication of a trend. So that's one lot of satellite data. And you can probe the satellite data in different ways. And what this shows is that the southern hemisphere is at about the same temperature as it was 28 years ago, and the northern hemisphere has warmed slightly. So the data tells a different story than the models. And in that circumstance, the scientific method suggests you shouldn't believe the data. And so these are the numbers. I won't dwell on them. I'm not so sure they're accurate to two decimal places, but they're indicative of the sort of level you would associate with unenhanced greenhouse effect from carbon dioxide. Now, this is the graph that started off all of the nonsense. It's the Mann graph. It is now almost completely discredited because it was done on bad statistics. It managed to erase the minor climactic optimum back in the Middle Ages, and much of the ClimateGate scandal was concerned with the discussions about how to suppress this rather awkward feature, because there wasn't a lot of carbon dioxide being generated by fossil fuel burning then. The carbon dioxide that was being generated then was mostly coming from wood, which was replenished. So it was a renewable. And it shows that there is nothing to fear, save fear itself. Now, another argument that comes up very often is, my gosh, there are many more extreme events occurring. Yeah. The BBC was at it again last week, talking about Death Valley, and we're likely to have a record high temperature. We didn't, and the existing record was still set 100 years ago. And if you remember the early charts that I showed you, 100 years ago we had emitted much less carbon than we did now. So what's going on is that the atmosphere and global weather patterns are not well understood. And it is facile for the Met Office to pretend that they are. I'm pleased to see that they did have a meeting to try to understand why the jet streams weren't wobbling. Because the key point that comes out of that meeting is that they don't understand why the jet stream is wobbling, and they don't understand why it's located where it is. So there are good reasons to spend money on meteorological research. It can have dire economic consequences. This is the Met Office. Predicted an average summer with a low risk of heavy rainfall, wettest on record. Then they predicted a mild winter, which was very cold. And the sad thing is that the politicians have accepted much of the hype and have legislated to produce adverse consequences. Now, I can either take you through the adverse consequences, but I see time is going on. But essentially, in the UK, the politicians decided to decarbonise the electricity supply. Now, if you think of the graphs that I showed you, and the tiny fraction that renewables contribute to the energy supply, the idea that we can decarbonise, how substantially decarbonise the electricity supply in 10 years is ridiculous. There is no way to build sufficient machines to do it, and the machines of choice by them at the moment, windmills, are profoundly inefficient, and in the absence of a good storage technology, they will not provide an adequate backup. If you install extra wind capacity, you necessarily have to install gas generating capacity to back it up when the power demand is high and the supply of wind is low. But having done that, they chose a particularly inopportune time, because our nuclear supply is coming down quite quickly, and so the margin on generating the available margin between capacity and peak demand has shrunk quite substantially. Not only that, they foolishly signed up to European legislation which would require the close down of perfectly effective and relatively clean, in the toxic and noxious sense, coal stations prematurely, which have exacerbated this problem to the point that Ofgem, the Office for Gas and Electricity Management, is issuing dire warnings to the government about narrow margins in electricity supply for the period 2015 to about 17. And if you look at the progression of those, if you look at their 2012 report, it says things are pretty bad. And if you look at their 2013 report, they say things have got worse. So there are adverse consequences arising not from the actuality of global warming, but from a belief in it. So there are other examples. If you make fuel prices high for transport, what you'll do is promote the use of diesel engines. In contrast to gasoline engines, which have very good cleanup systems, the three-way catalyst in a well-managed gasoline engine emits relatively clean gases from the back, carbon dioxide and water. A diesel engine emits rather nasty carcinogenic particulates and lots of nitrogen oxides. The first one is likely to give you, well, likely is too strong a word, is a source of cancerous irritation, and the second one certainly enhances asthma. So that in European cities now, the air quality is much worse than it is in American cities, where the prices of gasoline and diesel are very similar, and most people drive gasoline cars with the three-way catalyst. The last easy target there is the European Union rather foolishly banned resistive light bulbs. Resistive lighting is not a very large section of the power demand, but because they banned them, people necessarily had to migrate to mini fluorescents. Now, the thing about a mini fluorescent, it has quite a bit of mercury in it and it's fragile. So when they get broken, what happens is you dump mercury into the environment rather than carbon dioxide. The latter is inert and not particularly damaging of itself. Mercury is quite hazardous and quite difficult to clean up. So, is anthropogenic global warming a serious threat? Only if you're foolish enough to base policies on faith and approximate computer models rather than data and facts. So I think that we do have a crisis. The crisis is that people are perversely continuing with failed policies, which are likely to be both economically and physically damaging. There is one slide that I would like to show, which is this one. This is taken from the latest BP energy projections, and of course you might take a sharp intake of breath and say, self-interested oil companies, I won't believe that, but I'll show you in a minute why perhaps you should. And what this does is look at the probable outcomes by 2030 on a scenario which is essentially green policy implementation. And what it shows is that the burn goes up by a total, mostly in the non-OECD countries, and it grows quite substantially in terms of power generation. This is the burn of fossil fuel. And the composition, it's the energy burn, but the composition is oil, gas, coal, and only this comes from the renewables, hydro and nuclear. So almost all of the enhancement is going to cause more carbon dioxide emissions. So if you were taken with the what I would consider to be the alarmism of the modellers, then you really need to worry, because there is no way to avoid a massive increase in carbon dioxide emission. Longer term, if we don't panic, then there is quite a good sign on the horizon, because the cost per kilowatt hour generated by solar electric is falling so fast that on a reasonable expectation there'll be a price crossover sometime around the middle of this century, in which, or as a natural economic consequence, there'll be a migration away from fossil fuels on price grounds and towards solar electric. But the key unsolved technological problem there is to find either an efficient way of converting the solar electric electricity into fuel using highly efficient electrolysis, or to find an effective other energy storage technology. I have colleagues who are working on efficient electrolysis, and that's where I would put my money at the moment. So in the medium horizon, long after I'm dead, but before my grandchildren are dead, the problem will solve itself as a matter of normal technology development. And so a big question, especially for the younger members of the audience, is whether it's worth taking the hit on lower standards of living and all of the consequences that come from that in order to deal with what is probably an imaginary problem. And so I wanted to leave you with that thought for the present. Keep calm and carry on.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. We will keep it short. Can I urge people, I know there are a couple of regulars who'd like to come up and have a chat. We are not going to have the discussion being privately between you and Philip during the break. So a short break. We'll try and fill up as many glasses as we can. We've got squash and water left, I know. A little bit of wine as well. Will's got it off the fridge. Please come and help yourselves. We'll bring around the house as well. Please contribute. And then we'll come in again for the discussion. Thank you. Turn it off just in the